This podcast is powered by the Leading at the Top of Your Game development experience. If you would like to work with Karen and the shockingly different leadership team to up-level the leadership execution acumen within your organization, visit developingyourgame.com to find out more.
They accused me of bullying, and I thought, okay, so once again, you know, we resolved that. And in fact, my lawyer said to me, Barden, you're much too soft to be a bully. But so I'll take you on. But the point that I went was, hang on, why did they choose bullying? Why didn't they choose the fact that I didn't have any hair? Do you know what I mean? Why did they choose bullying? There must have been something in there that was. And I realized that one of the things was that I had not taken into account the change in culture.
Welcome to the Lead at the Top of Your Game podcast, where we equipped you to more effectively lead your seat at any employer, business, or industry in which you choose to play. Each week, we help you sharpen your leadership acumen by cracking open the playbooks of dynamic leaders who are doing big things in their professional endeavors. And now your host, leadership tactics and organizational development expert, Karen Farrell Rhodes.
Hey there, everyone, and thanks for joining another episode designed to help you better lead at the top of your game. Now, as you know, for season 3, each month we're featuring leaders who have interesting roles in a particular profession or industry. And on today's episode, it's part of our special series featuring the perspectives of leadership coaches who focus on a particular angle of leadership. And on today's show, we're featuring an expert who has completed extensive research on how successful leaders leverage partnerships. We're honored to have Dr. Stephen Barden. He's the founder and CEO of Stephen Barden Coaching Limited, and he's also the author of the book, How Successful Leaders Do Business with Their World. Now, believe you me, you're going to be absolutely captivated as you listen to Stephen's journey from once being part of the anti-apartheid movement when he was younger, and then because he was part of the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, he was expelled to Great Britain. And then from there, he went through school and started his career journey, rising up the executive ranks to the top of the top, only to be accused of bullying due to his hard-charging attitude. Now, this experience motivated him to conduct his doctoral research, where he uncovered one of the critical success factors of successful leaders from across the globe. So definitely stay tuned and listen to all of his insights and lessons learned. And remember to stay just tuned for just 2 minutes after the episode to listen to my closing segment called Karen's Take, where I share a tip on how to use insights from today's episode to further sharpen your leadership acumen. And now, enjoy the show. Hey there, superstars. This is Karen, and welcome to another episode of the Lead at the Top of Your Game podcast. We are so happy that you have given us the gift of your time to join in on another episode. We have a tremendous friend on today's podcast, a friend from across the pond, even further, and based in Germany today, but he's going to tell his story. But we're so pleased to have on today's show Dr. Stephen Barden. And Stephen is the founder and CEO of Stephen Barden Coaching Limited, and he's also the author of the book, How Successful Leaders Do Business with Their World. And you know we're going to want to know deeply what his book is all about and the research that he conducted based that was the production of the book, that it was the foundation for the book, I should say. He is a renowned leadership coach and mediator with over a decade of experience at the CEO levels and board levels of companies. And he has been in a variety of industries, including media, technology, and the communication sector. He's worked across Europe and the United States, and he's really fantastic at helping organizations develop sustainable and ethical cultures that are aligned with their business strategy. And for my HR friends out there, he's also a tremendous partner in helping HR departments on governance and sustainable work practices that you know we all struggle with. So welcome to the show, Stephen.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Good to be here. And thanks for the invitation.
So honored to have you. Well, Before we jump into a lot of meaty information, and audience members, get your notepads ready because I'm sure he has a lot to share. But Stephen, we would first love, for as much as you feel comfortable, for you to share just a sneak peek into where you're based, your personal life, and maybe a passion or two that you like.
Well, bit of a nomad, a bit like you, I think, bit of a nomad. I was, funny enough, born and brought up in Tanzania, in East Africa. Then my parents, for their sins, sent me to South Africa in the bad old days of apartheid, where I went to university and started off as a broadcasting career. And then, because I got involved with the anti-apartheid movement, I was then detained briefly by the apartheid regime and then expelled into Britain. So that was quite fun. And I arrived there with my then wife, my baby son, and a Nagra tape recorder. And I spent the next 30 years in Britain as a CEO and first as a journalist and then as a COO and then a CEO and then went into practice. And I now live in Germany for just over 6 months. Careful with this one. It's all about tax purposes.
Just over right. 6 months.
and then the minority of the time in the south of France. So and my company is still based in the UK. So that's where I am. Passion, I love it when strategies work out, when I'm able to work with an organization. And this was my passion, of course, when I was also running organizations, when a plan works out and it works out not because it was perfectly planned, but because we had plan A, plan B, and plan C, and we got to where we wanted. That's really what makes me truly happy, I promise you. Yeah.
You know, we're so alike in that fashion because, you know, I'm all about leadership execution and making sure people don't, you know, stall because they don't or know their next step or they're afraid of their next step. You know, I always say we can work it out or figure it out together. But, you know, if we get through to the end, boy, I'm the first to pop the bubbly in celebration because that journey is so much fun. And it sounds like it is for you, too.
Yeah, yeah. And it's yeah. Interesting because I think I used to irritate my executive directors when I was running companies. And I think I irritate my clients as much when I say to them, so we work into a plan and what we're going to do. And then I say, so when are you going to do that? And they say, well, what do you mean? I said, when are you going to try it out? You've got to go and try it out. Go and try it out. When are you going to do that? They go, do I have to? Yes, you have. It's a good idea to go and do it. Then come back, let's review what went wrong. But I can still see the same sort of mark of irritation on the forehead when they do that.
But I know that doesn't deter you, though, does it?
No,
it just
not
at all. You just keep pushing, gently pushing to keep them on track.
Of course, yeah.
Well, fantastic. Well, Stephen, I'm just curious, you know, you've had so much experience, especially in the organizational development realm. You know, why do you think organizational cultures are so important to a business's success and the people who are there, their success?
I have this, is it a mania? Almost a mania, but part of it, which is basically says that organizational culture needs to be completely aligned with the strategy of the organization. So it's, I remember in the financial crash when I was working with a number of banks, a number of investment banks, and there was one I remember I walked in to do some coaching there, and they were engraved on the wall, deeply engraved on the wall was team spirit and partnership and integrity. And I thought, well, the first time I walked onto the floor, I remember I found two traders knocking the heck out of each other because there was no team. The entire purpose of the organization was independent trading. So what was all this team spirit about? And I learned quickly a lesson there that basically, unless you have a culture that says, unless you start with the strategy that says, this is where we want to go to, this is what we're doing, this is how we're going to do it, these are the talents and skills, etc., then that culture has to grow from there. You can't have cannot impose a culture on something, on a strategy that is not aligned. You know, the facetious example I always give is, you know, if you're running a company of sharpshooters, of snipers, you're not going to impose a culture on this organization of compassion and and team spirit and all those things, because it's simply one or the other will go awry. Either the strategy will break down and you'll create some really bad sharpshooters, or the culture will arise. So it's got to be aligned. And once you do that, then you've got a chance and keep on enforcing that and keep on reviewing that. Then you've got a chance of making sure that your culture and your strategy work together. So culture for me, you know, I think somebody said, what was it? The culture eats strategy for breakfast. Well, you know what? They actually can eat each other to death. You know, it's like that symbol of the snake eating its own tail. You do have to have those two aligned. So that's massively important. And it's an interesting thing you brought up there, because one of the things I've been thinking about is what happens to organizational culture and that whole ethos of community that we want to, that is so powerful in organizations, if we stay only at home, if we work only at home. What happens to that culture? So, you know, when people say to me,
we're in a real life case study right now, right? Life after the pandemic. And what do you think? What are some of the trends that you're seeing out there with remote work? Is it working or not?
It works and it doesn't. It depends how rigid it is. If people, you get certain organizations where they're basically saying, no, everybody's got to come in. That's it, finished. The issue with that is then you're saying, no, now I'm going to have to regiment you, and I'm putting you in place where you have to just completely abide. There is no room for any flexibility. The ability to be able to go back into the home, if you like, at times, whatever it is, once or twice a week, whatever it is important, because it gives you that space to do that. But to have either, you know, totally remote working, where you can with professional services, legal services, et cetera, or totally at work, totally in the office, is problematic, I think. The other thing is that when you work from home, you're not working from home, actually. You're living at work.
Ah, interesting. Got an interesting point. Say more about that.
Certainly during the pandemic and afterwards, I found people becoming more and more exhausted. So I would say, so why are you exhausted? Well, I finished at 11 last night. Why did you finish at 11 last night? You're not doing surgery here. Why did you finish at 11? Well, because, you know, I was at the desk and I needed to do, so I just carried on doing it, you know. And what did your husband say? Or what did your wife say? Well, they get very frustrated. But the temptation, one, to continue working because I am at work, right?
Right.
And I don't have to do anything other than go and get myself a cup of coffee from the kitchen. That's one. And number two, the temptation for employers to phone people up at 10 o'clock at night and say, by the way, I forgot this. Could you do this? Which they wouldn't.
You know,
there is a
they normally do.
The walls go down. That's the issue with
it. Can I share just a little anecdote with you very quickly? So before I started my firm, the last big gig I had in corporate was working at Microsoft. And all my listeners know that. And I was there for 14 years. And 12 of those 14 years, I was 100% remote. And to your point, and it was fantastic. I mean, it was absolutely wonderful. And I did a lot of roles there. I had about 5 or 6 roles while I was at Microsoft. But every single one of them, I was able to work from home. But to your point, I think it can work working from home, because obviously myself and our team was very successful in doing so. We had a global team and most of us worked from home, but we had prepared all of our key stakeholders for that, meaning we had boundaries on what were the norms of contacting versus not contacting. We were intentional about meetup every quarter, you know, meeting in a different country, and we all come together for some, you know, collaboration and what have you. And we were very self-disciplined. And so I know it can work, but what I think that what happened with the pandemic is we, meaning the globe, hadn't prepared our workforces for that type a transition or visioning that. So the small group of people like me and my team who were able to do it well, we had been intentional around putting together an infrastructure to help it go as well as it could be. I mean, granted, yes, you know, seeing everybody every day, it brings a lot to the table as well. But I think that's what the pandemic did. It didn't allow us to prepare our workforces for that new way of working. And it didn't allow us to prepare our leaders to lead through the new way of working. And I think that's where a lot of the tension came aboard. But I'm curious if you see that as well, if you think that was one of the reasons why it didn't work.
I think that's right. I think that's right. The other thing that worries me still a little bit about it is that when you're doing, there are two sides. One, by the way, when you're running a multinational organization or in a multinational organization, you're going to do a lot of remote working. You're going to a lot of my relationships, certainly when I was running organizations, were, you know, a general manager or a COO in a different country. So, you know, we would contact each other by video or whatever at the time. But the other thing is that those relationships that were remote were much more transactional. You're sitting in the same place, you know, doing your video conferencing or whatever you're doing. And then my relationship with you is going to be not here, but if we were working to, would be much more transactional than to be able to say, hey, should we just go and have some coffee together? Or, hey, changing location in a funny sort of way, doing things together helps to create relationships beyond the purely transactional. Professional relationships, but absolutely, not purely transactional. And that's what creates the bond, the real cement in relationships. That's what worries me.
I agree. And I definitely agree with you, because one of the things that I was intentional about was when we called it the mothership, when we had to go to Redmond in near Seattle, where Microsoft is based. I had to go there frequently, obviously, being a leader and having to meet with other leaders. But when I did, I'd make sure my whole week was full of coffees, lunches, and dinners with colleagues, just to increase that personal connection. Because you're right, when you're on video, you're doing the work, you know, and you might have a little small talk, but other than that, it is very transactional.
Yeah. And even when you're sharing ideas, I think, you know, sharing ideas over a coffee, over a lunch, or walking in the, you know, the on the campus, that generates trust. It generates, you get to know your colleagues in a different way. Yeah.
In a deeper way. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's true.
All right. Well, Stephen, I hope you don't mind us switching gears. I want to spend a bit of time really understanding the background and foundation of your book that is called How Successful Leaders Do Business with Their World. And I'm fascinated about that. So can you share what drove you to do the research and maybe some of the findings out of it, out of your book?
Sure. I mean, very briefly, I decided to do a doctorate in 2015. So it was late in life one. So after accumulating quite a lot of experience. And the reason I did it was because I had been fired from my last job. My last CEO job, I was fired. It turned out well, but basically I was fired. And they accused me of bullying. And I thought, okay, so again, once again, you know, that was resolved that. And in fact, my lawyer said to me, Barden, you're much too soft to be a bully. So I'll take you on. But the point that I went was, hang on, why did they choose bullying? Why didn't they choose the fact that I didn't have any hair or the fact that I perhaps was dry? Do you know what I mean? Why did they choose bullying? There must have been something in there that was... And I realized that one of the things was that I had not taken into account the change in culture. I had come from the media business where it was very hierarchical in those days. You know, as an editor of an organization or as a managing editor, as I had been, and the CEO, if I said, this is what I want to be done, nobody questioned it. They did it. So it was quite hierarchical. It was quite normal to be so. When I went into a business which I was trying to change from a white goods company to a technology company, if you like, to a service company, it was different. And these people were, so I thought, that could be a reason. So let me go and find out. So I thought what I want to do is I want to find out from really successful, objectively successful leaders, how they experience their learning. And I selected, and I promised that they would be anonymous for a very good reason, a group of top-notch 2-, 3-, 4-star generals from Europe and from the UK. I selected top university academics from universities and colleges and schools, federations, and I selected global CEOs, a group of global CEOs. And I said, okay, so this is what I want. Tell me about your experiences, how you learned, what you selected, why you did this, why you did that. And they kept on talking to me about their childhood. They kept on saying, when I was a child, I used to do this. When I was a child, I was this. And I thought, why do they keep on talking? But it was important to them because they kept on insisting on it. That, to cut a long story short, what we discovered, and I'm saying we because it was the type of research where I kept on throwing back the research to them and saying, this is what you said. Can you validate? Can you validate for it? So it was, that was what it was done. And what we discovered was that all these leaders, and therefore I'm extrapolating, we could extrapolate to human beings, if you like, they formed foundational assumptions about the relationship with their world and in terms of power. And it reminds me, by the way, of William Isaacson's book about Musk, when Musk also, apparently, according to the book, kept on turning back to the childhood, And it is that foundational assumption the child will then say and starts to build that as a foundation. This is my relationship to the world. My world is either so powerful I can't do anything about it, in which case I have been, you know, mostly with totally abused children. Or on the other hand, you know, if you're royalty, my world is so weak I can do anything I like with it. Or the sweet spot with these really successful leaders was right in the middle. And they're basically, but they were able to say, as one person put them, I can do business with this world. The world is my partner. The world is my ally. I will use the resource and it will use me. We can work together to achieve things. They never do anything alone, for example, these leaders. So that's what I discovered with them. And they, from there, there was, and that's what I called the partnering stance. It was the partnering form of leadership. And from there, I developed this model and what I continue to coach on, which is how do you become a partnering leader? Don't lead from the front, because leading from the front means you're always going to have to look behind you and you will fall over and in the mud. How do you work with people? And they always, this lot, you know, when we're talking about wartime generals, if you like, who had served in conflict, they always worked with people around them, always worked with partners, always took advice, always thought very carefully with people. They never, you know, led on their own. And they formed certain, not traits, but certain behaviors, certain assumptions, if you like. For example, you know, they're really, really aware of everything that goes on in the organization. And they treat it as an ecosystem. So all the linkages, they will always draw linkages. They never have just one plan. They will have plan A, plan B, and plan C, and plan D if necessary. They will, you know, they have things like when you were talking about, you know, having the courage to do things, they will do, I think, I can't remember whether I coined it or one of them coined the phrase, they will do the best possible until that best is no longer possible, and then they will change the possible.
Yes, so that makes a ton of sense.
So do you see what I mean? So in fact, even if sometimes the possible that they've been aiming for is no longer best, so they'll think, I need to do even better than that. So, and they always had, you could see throughout their careers, they had mentors that they worked with. These are not sentimental relationships. They would, you know, discard their mentors as they went along because that as they had developed. And the astounding thing about all of them, and I've continued to do research as I continue with my practice, they had very small egos because, you know what? It wasn't their ego that was at play here. It was completing the job. What we talked about earlier on as being one of my passions, and by the way, I was not a great leader, but at least I learned this, is the job was really important. The job was completing the job, doing the job, taking that whole ship forward, not just you know, parts of it. They wouldn't work on behalf of the shareholders only or the staff only or HR only. They would work on behalf of the entire
organization,
all the stakeholders. That was really vital. So that's what they would do. And they also It reminds me, just as a slight thing, I remember when I was first a COO, number two to an organization, and my CEO said, could you run this, could you chair the meeting, this meeting for me of senior stakeholders, because I'm going to be late. So I did. And then he came in right at the end. And when we finished the meeting, I said, Sam, how did I do? And he said, Barden, stop acting like a leader, do the job. Do the job. And that's all it was. So from there, just another, I might as well throw another one in, which is competing is a complete waste of time because you're doing the job. You're not competing against, you know, Microsoft is not competing against Apple, is not competing against its, if it's going to succeed, it's going to do its job, what its vision is going to be.
Right.
So that was very important. And the other thing that I worry about slightly, which not slightly, quite a lot actually, because is when people talk about style of leadership.
Oh, yeah.
If you talk about style, then no, you're not doing this. There's no style here. What is your way of doing it to be able to take the whole ship forward? How do you do
be effective in doing that? Yeah.
In fact, the title I was going to use for this book before the publishers intervened was Do the Damn Job. Because that's
I love that. I love that. Well, this one works well too. But yeah, both of those titles will work well. But when you were just explaining, I had a moment of epiphany, aha moment, when you said around childhood, and I was thinking, well, how does that apply, you know, to me? And you always think internally. You know, I was a daddy's girl, and my dad had a small group. I call them kind of the wolf pack, if you will, of friends who were dignitaries and significant folks in our where I grew up. I always call them the big fish in a small pond. But to that extent, I never spoke, but he always let me sit in the same room or on the, you know, do things while they were talking and planning and what have you. But what I observed were these six individuals were superstars in their own right. I mean, very knowledgeable, they were great leaders. But what they did was they were specialists in certain areas, and they would pull their knowledge together to talk and to help each other and to talk about approaches or to, you know, what have you. But observing them collaborating together, and to your point, there were no egos, they were friends, you know, they had a lot of laughs and, you know, things, but the power was in collaborating as a whole and then taking their lessons learned and applying it back into their own professions, if you will. And so when you were talking about the whole, you know, what you observe, I grew up understanding, and I grew up in the Deep South where it was challenging to be a person of color back then. But I grew up with, there's always a way. There's no one that's better than you. There's always people that could be on your side to keep, you know, move things forward. And so when you were explaining all that, I'm like, oh my God, this is just like therapy for me. Dr. Steve is researching.
You're actually seeing this model of power. And of course, you were making your space in it. You were seeing, you were making your own space within it by saying, okay, because nobody was blocking you, weren't they? They weren't going, go away, don't, you know, little girl, go away. They were actually allowing you, letting you to be there. So you were making your space in there. And you were also seeing them, how they flowed within, and seeing this partnering stance in action. These were big people, big brains, big achievements who were working together. And that must have been an extraordinary foundational assumption. So you're quite right. As you said, you formed this basic assumption. There's always a way. There are always people who can help. That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Can you, if you're uncomfortable about this, I totally understand, but we so rarely have someone on the line that was a CEO that ended up transitioning out. And I know you shared some of your lessons learned, but it's amazing that there's life after a difficult transition when you're the one at the top. kind of share how you were able to be resilient and take that in stride and move forward? I know you did some of the research probably drove, you know, your feelings from that situation, but I'd love for the listeners to understand that sometimes you're dealt a hand that's not the one you'd love, but there is life after your current gig. Yeah.
I think it's a very good question in the sense that I've thought about it a lot. So it's a great question, clever question. Well done. I think here's the thing. When that happened to me, for the first time in my life, I didn't panic in the sense. I didn't go, because I'd always drove forward. Next job, next job, next job, next job. I didn't panic. I said, nope. And this was the first time I'd been fired in any sense. It was absolutely the first time. So I said, okay, sit down and just write and think and reflect. So for a year, I reflected and the core of my reflection was what happened to my values and to my, which ones are my values rather than the values that I'd inherited from society. What values had been distorted by being in corporate life for 30 years? What had changed? So that's what I did for a start. Then, and of course, that was a cleansing process in itself. And then I said, okay, do you want to go back into corporate life? And I thought, no, I don't. I don't want to go back into corporate. What are you good at doing? What can you do is help people who are in corporate life. And then who are you going to help? People at your level who at that CEO, at that C-suite level, who are able to do things. That was the process that I went through. The difficulty, of course, and which was quite difficult, is stopping myself from thinking that I had been a CEO, if that makes sense. So I would go in my head.
That was your identity for so long.
Absolutely. I was a CEO. So I would go, I was a CEO.
Right.
And then somebody said to me with about, 6 months experience in coaching, Stephen, don't say you're a CEO. Don't say you're a CEO. Because if you do that, you're not going to be able to coach, to mentor, to enable. You're going to be managing. So stop. So that was the difficulty I had to shed, certainly. And I shed that within the first 6 months. And of course, there is no status. You have to build your own self-esteem, basically, which was actually wonderful to come to think about it.
Oh, amazing. Well, thank you so much for sharing that. It sounds like that journaling and the writing really helped you reflect and get to a point where you could figure out your next step. And that's absolutely fantastic. Well, I know we are short on time, but before we let you go, one of the questions that we always love to ask our guests is which of the leadership execution tactics that I wrote about in my book really resonated for you? And you were so kind enough to share that leading with intrapreneurship kind of jumped out for you. And for my new audience listeners, if you're not aware, leading with intrapreneurship is all about building an organization by identifying new opportunities to improve products, services, or processes. So it's all about bringing that creativity and innovation to an organization. So I'm just curious, Stephen, why did that one particularly resonate with you?
Because I think particularly in corporations, particularly in well-established organizations, and I've seen it here, by the way, in Germany with the car industry, the temptation is to say, well, we've done this, we're very good at this, we don't really need to improve other than incrementally. And as we've seen, incrementalism in many ways means that the idea of innovating, the idea of moving forward and creating new products and services, of thinking completely differently, is stifled. So, and we can't do that because the world is changing and has always changed very quickly, certainly in the last century and a half. So for me, a successful organization requires entrepreneurship, requires the ability to be able, in that culture, to be able for people to say, this is my idea, what do you think? And for it to be welcomed with open arms and looked at critically, yes, but not looked at with defensiveness. So that's what I really do truly believe is all the organizations that I work with I tend to work with this to try and get them to think about how to innovate, how to think of new ideas, how to think differently so that they don't get caught by surprise.
Love that. Absolutely love that. Thank you so much for sharing that, Stephen. Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap up. But before we do so, I know audience will have a ton of links in the show notes to where you can find Stephen, how to get his book, how to learn more about his firm's consulting. But I would love, Stephen, to give you a voice to share as well right here on the podcast. So how can people find you if they want to connect with you?
I think the best way is via LinkedIn. So it's Stephen Barden at LinkedIn. So that's the best. And there I do a very active and do a number of posts, a number of articles. I also have a podcast in which I talk about the whole thing of this balance of power, or the power of balance, as I call it. And it's called the power of balance. I've also just started, just completely differently, I've also started a podcast on refugees and migrants, people. So, and here's what I'm learning, by the way, just very briefly, I'm learning how we can learn about leadership from them and about resilience, because extraordinary resilience, extraordinary leadership. So I'm doing that. So that podcast is called Migrant Odyssey. Power of Balance is the one that I do about my book and about the research and about leadership. The LinkedIn is where you can find me mostly. In fact, all of me, if you like. And the book, if anybody should be, you know, should want to take a look at it, as you said, is How Successful Leaders Do Business with Their World.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Stephen, for being a guest on our podcast. We really appreciate your time and your gift of knowledge.
Thank you very much. And lovely, warm conversation. I really enjoyed that very much.
Oh, wonderful. We loved having you. And thank you also, listeners, for tuning in to another episode. We know that there are many podcasts you can listen to, but we're very honored that you joined us again for this week, and hopefully see you next week as well. Have a great one. Well, I hope you enjoyed our conversation today with Dr. Stephen Barden, founder and CEO of Stephen Barden Coaching Limited. Links to his bio, his entry into our leadership playbook, and additional resources can be found in the show notes, both on your favorite podcast platform of choice and on the web at leadyourgamepodcast.com. And now for Karen's take on today's topic of leveraging partnerships to be a better leader. Now, in addition to what great insights Stephen shared with us, I'd like to share just a few more thoughts. You know, while partnering with others can be complex, if you can navigate how to do so, it has the potential to fast track your leadership efforts faster than if you had to operate alone. And to do this effectively, I feel you need to do three things. One, find out what your team or potential colleagues desire or value. Don't guess, ladies and gentlemen. Take the time to talk to them one-on-one, because every human has their own set of values and list of incentives that will be meaningful for them. Secondly, during your conversation, take the time to validate which individuals would actually benefit from partnering with you. Just because someone has the knowledge or skills does not mean that they have the time or motivation. And without these two present, you're inviting trouble onto your team. And then lastly, once you have your partners or teammates identified and bought in, then I suggest that you be intentional about aligning all of them behind your leadership effort at hand, and then motivating them to execute. Now, as much as you can without betraying their confidences, I really encourage you to invite the members of your team to be transparent about what a quote-unquote win would be for them. This way, the entire team can be accountable for ensuring everyone gets what they need from the experience, versus only you being accountable alone just because you have the title of leader. For example, you can say something like, "Hey, Jim, I know you wanted to learn more about pricing, so why don't you take the lead in working with a consulting firm to evaluate the pricing and market data that they've come with and help see where the trends are?" By doing so, this verbal validation will help each of your team members feel heard and will go a long way in increasing goodwill. So those are a couple things just to think about, and that's all for today. But please remember to subscribe to the podcast and share with just one friend, because by doing so, you will empower them to also lead at the top of their game. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. And that's our show for today. Thank you for listening to the Lead at the Top of Your Game podcast, where we help you lead your seat at any employer, business, or industry in which you choose to play. You can check out the show notes, additional episodes, bonus resources, and also submit guest recommendations on our website at leadyourgamepodcast.com. You can follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn by searching for the name Karen Rhodes, with Karen being spelled K-A-R-A-N. And if you like the show, the greatest gift you can give would be to subscribe and leave a rating on your podcast platform of choice. This podcast has been a production of Shockingly Different Leadership, a global consultancy which helps organizations execute their people, talent development, and organizational effectiveness initiatives on an on-demand project or contract basis. Huge thanks to our production and editing team for a job well done. Goodbye for now.